My guest, Philip Zimbardo, has spent much of his career studying the psychology of evil. He's famous for creating the 1971 Stanford Prison Experiment, in which he created a mock prison and divided a group of student volunteers into guards and prisoners. Within a week, the guards became so sadistic that Zimbardo terminated the experiment. He thinks this experiment can help us understand how American soldiers became abusive at Abu Ghraib. Zimbardo was an expert witness in the court-martial hearings of one of the American Army reservists accused of criminal behavior in Abu Ghraib. Zimbardo is a professor emeritus at Stanford University and the author of the new book, The Lucifer Effect, Understanding How Good People Turn Evil. Let's start with an overview of the Stanford Prison Experiment. The goal was to assess how an institutional setting can override the internal dispositions of the people in that setting.
We went to great lengths to pick young men who were normal and healthy based on psychological tests and other assessments, and we randomly divided them into two conditions. Half would be guards and half would be prisoners. And so at the beginning of the study, we knew that we had only good apples in our bad barrel. In a very short time, the guards began to move into behaving in sadistic, cruel, dehumanizing ways against the prisoners. Prisoners who were chosen because they were normal and healthy began to have emotional breakdowns, extreme stress reactions. So I had to end the study after 6 days because it was getting out of control. I no longer felt that I, either as the superintendent of the prison or principal investigator, could control the guards. That is, their behavior is getting more and more extreme. And so we aborted the mission after 6 days.
Would you describe some of the behavior that you found to be extreme that was very concerning to you?
Well, the one thing I did is to tell the guards that a physical force, physical violence was not acceptable, was not allowed. And so if they touched the prisoner with their big billy clubs, it was the equivalent of hitting them. There was some, in fact, physical violence on the second day when the prisoners revolted and challenged the guards. And the guards stripped them naked, broke into their cells, shot carbon dioxide fumes from fire extinguishers at them, chained them up, put them in solitary. And then after that, I said, you know, no physical force. What I did not limit is psychological violence. And so the smart college students began to develop creatively evil ways to first make the environment totally arbitrary so that prisoners could not figure out what they had to do to get the guards to not abuse them. And then over time, what happened is sexuality moved in, and that degrading the prisoners first through nakedness, put bags over their heads, and then essentially playing sexual games with them, you know, having them play leapfrog, and when they're jumping over each other, their genitals are banging on each other's heads. You know, horrible things like that started happening, and at that point we realized, you know, this is out of control.
Let me point out the obvious, which is some of what you're describing sounds very similar to what happened in Abu Ghraib. I mean, there's a photograph in your book of several of the, quote, prisoners with bags over their heads that look not unlike the prisoner with a hood on his head in one of the Abu Ghraib photos. And you're talking about simulating sodomy-like positions to humiliate the prisoners. When you were watching this basically on closed-circuit television. What went through your mind when you saw the psychological degradation that the guards were putting the prisoners through in your study?
Well, see, I made the mistake of playing the role of prison superintendent in addition to being the principal investigator. I never should have done that. The problem was we had very limited resources. This whole study was done for like $2,500. And it was just me, two graduate students, Craig Haney, Kurt Banks, and one undergraduate who played the role of the warden, and Carlo Prescott, who was a former ex-convict. He was our consultant. So we had a very small staff, and we have to be there 24 hours around the clock. And so over time, you know, we also were under stress, and our judgment was, you know, not top of the line the way it should have been. But in the role of prison superintendent, you're looking at this and you're saying, wow, that's amazing that, you know, the guards thought of this creative thing. your morality has changed. You don't step back and say, this is horrendous what you know good young men are doing to other good young men. And so I was passive when I should have been active. I should have ended the study after 2 days. It only took 36 hours for the first president to have an emotional breakdown. In fact, he was the ringleader of the rebellion. So here's this tough kid. He had been an anti-war activist at Berkeley. And he's broken in 2 days. And then each day after that, that became the way out of this alleged mock prison. Each day another prisoner would break down, either emotionally or develop a full body rash, psychosomatic rash. So within 6 days, five of the nine prisoners that we had emotional breakdowns. And so we ended the study, but I should have ended it after the first prisoner broke down.
Is it possible that the quote, prison guards were thinking that they were fulfilling your expectations, that you were expecting them to be sadistic or to humiliate the prisoners, and they did their job in kind of going to the extremes that you were looking for?
To some extent, what we created there was a system called the psychology of imprisonment. Before I did this study, I taught a course at Stanford with Carlo Prescott, in which we brought in ex-convicts and guards and wardens and prison chaplains. So we got to understand what is the essential psychology, what is the mentality of being a guard, what is the mentality of being a prisoner, and what is the psychological foundation of prisons. And prisons are about one thing, they're about power, they're about control. They're about dominance of some people over other people. Sadism is not part of it. That emerges from the power of the role. What guards have to do is they have to demonstrate to prisoners that they are powerful and prisoners are powerless. And that's the role you have to play. On the first day, nothing happened. I was going to end the study after the first day because it was very awkward. It was hard to get into the role of being a prison guard by these students. This is 1971. These are anti-war activists. These are civil rights activists. Not one of the volunteers, and we interviewed 75 before we picked the final 24. Not one of them said, you want to be a guard or a prisoner? They all said, I don't want to be a guard. I didn't go to college to be a prison guard. You know, I might be a prisoner at some time. So there wasn't any latent tendency to be aggressive, to be a tough guard. And so what I'm saying is the instructions I gave them had no effect on day one, and it was only when the prisoners revolted on day two that the guard said, these are dangerous prisoners. We have to show them who's boss. And after that, then the role took over and had nothing to do with any expectations that I had created in them.
When did you call off the experiment? What was the last straw?
Well, on Thursday night, we started on Sunday. This is 5 days into it. I had invited a number of psychology students, young faculty, to come down and interview everybody, give us an appraisal from outsiders who know nothing about this study of how it was going. And one of the people who came down was a former student of mine who had just started as a professor at Berkeley, Christina Maslach. And she came down, and it was 10 o'clock at night. 10 o'clock was the toilet run. It was the last time prisoners could go to the toilet. After that, they had to urinate, defecate in buckets in their cell. And what she saw was what happened in the toilet run. Prisoners were lined up, bags put over their head, legs chained together, you know, and marching, you know, counting off. And I'm looking up, and I say, hey, Chris, look at that. And she looks and turns away. I said, hey, look at that. Isn't that interesting? And she starts tearing up and says, it's terrible what you're doing to those boys, and runs out. And I run after, and we have this big argument. Don't you understand? It's the crucible of human nature. And all that. And she said, I don't care what it is. Those are boys. They're not prisoners. They're not subjects in an experiment. They are boys, and you are responsible for what's happening to them. And it was like a slap in the face. I mean, she broke through this illusion. And what's important is that at least 50 people had come down, a prison chaplain, a Catholic prison chaplain. Parents came down for visiting night, girlfriends, boyfriends. There were psychologists who looked in. There were psychologists on the parole board. There were secretaries on the parole board. All these people came and said, oh, it's really interesting. It's interesting simulation. It's very realistic. And she was the one who said, the emperor has no clothes. And so at that moment, I said, you're right. We have to end the study. And then the other thing she said, we had just started dating, she said, you have been transformed by this study, that you were a kind, caring, loving person, and now I see this, essentially authoritarian monster.
I should mention you're married now. You've been married for, 25 years?
35 years.
35 years.
We have a wonderful family, and she is, I dedicate the book to her as the serene heroine of my life.
What conclusions did you draw after terminating the study? And, how do you look at it now, 35 years later?
We like to believe that all of human behavior is generated by things inside of us. It's all genetically determined. It's our personality. It's our character. It's our moral rearing. And what the Stanford Prison Study says, along with Stanley Milgram's famous Yale studies on blind obedience to authority, is that in many situations, especially novel ones that we're not familiar with, we can be transformed. Like the guards, like the prisoners in the Stanford Prison Study, we can do things that are unimaginable to us when we're outside of that situation, so that we can be controlled by playing a role, by taking our identity away, by being anonymous, by dehumanizing the other person, so that social psychology tells us that although you respect the dignity of the individual does not always operate out of free will, does not always act rationally, that we are often subjects to the situation, and our life is all situations. We're always in schools, in families, in jobs, in prisons, in hospitals. So that Stanford Prison Study says, here's how powerful but subtle situational forces can sometimes overwhelm the best and brightest of us.
What parallels do you see between the Stanford Prison Experiment and what you've learned about Abu Ghraib? And I should mention here that you testified for the defense of Sergeant Ivan Chip Frederick, who was accused of placing wires on a prisoner's hands while the prisoner was standing on a box, and the sergeant told the prisoner that he'd be electrocuted if he fell off the box. So your conclusions about how a system can change a person?
No, in this case, the analysis is when we understand what were the psychological dynamics operating in that prison in Abu Ghraib, all of those that I've, in everything I know, says they're exact parallels, not only the visual parallels of the nakedness and bags and sexual games, it's the underlying psychological dynamics, dehumanization of the prisoners. Everybody is anonymous. Everybody's playing these roles.
So what did you say when you testified on behalf of Sergeant Chip Frederick?
Well, the first thing that's really important for your listeners to realize is he said immediately, I am guilty. I did that. I deserve to be punished. I'm willing to die for my country. I don't know why I did it, because typically when you're trapped in one of these powerful situational force fields, you're unaware of how you are changing. In the same way I was unaware of how I changed in just 6 days as the superintendent of Stanford Prison Study. My statement was to say, here are the powerful situational forces that made this good American patriotic soldier, good father, good husband, good citizen, be transformed. And he's guilty and he's willing to serve time, but understanding the situational dynamics should mitigate the severity of the sentence. And that's all a situational analysis can do in our legal system. It had almost no effect on the military court. His sentence was 8 years in prison. He was dishonorably discharged. And then even they took away 22 years of his retirement pay. They took away his he had 9 medals and awards. He was in the National Guard and Army Reserve. And they stripped those publicly on the courthouse steps. And then they sent him to Kuwait in solitary confinement. So my sense was the situational analysis had no impact on the military. And in fact, the prosecutor, in his closing statement, essentially said that Chip Frederick, and the others, bad apples, rogue soldiers, really humiliated the military. And it was not about what they did. It was about the photos. Because it was the first time in history that we saw American soldiers not only abusing prisoners, but putting themselves in the picture. And so these are trophy photos. These are like photos we saw in the past of Americans putting themselves in pictures of lynching. But this was, so this humiliated the military and humiliated the Bush administration.
The military has been using psychologists.
Oh boy.
To consult with interrogators. Now, some psychologists say that this is very unethical, and that it makes psychologists implicit in techniques that might be torture. What the military says is, no, the psychologists are helping the interrogators understand points in which they might be vulnerable in terms of supplying information, but also, you know, how to not go too far, how to protect the person being interrogated. As the former head of the American Psychological Association, what is your personal view about that? And I should mention that a panel from the American Psychological Association recently said that psychologists participating in terror-related interrogations are fulfilling, quote, a valuable and ethical role to assist in protecting our nation, other nations, and innocent civilians from harm. So what do you think?
It's a very complicated issue. The problem is that psychologists want to help in national security. Psychologists want their research to be meaningful, and this is one area in which it can be meaningful. I draw a very sharp line, a very bright line, between giving generic information about persuasion, about everything we know about compliance, obedience. And that's, for me, that's okay. It is not okay to give specific information about the vulnerability of a particular individual based on the psychological knowledge assessment of that individual to interrogators. That, for me, that's violating a basic principle of do no harm. That the person that is being interrogated is an individual who's innocent until proven guilty. And to give information to an interrogator about how to break that individual, for me, that steps across the ethical boundary. And there's a big controversy in the American Psychological Association, which I think is actually going to explode in the next few months.
Over this issue of psychologists
saying, no, this is wrong. The American Psychological Association should be condemning this kind of use of psychological knowledge. And other psychologists saying, no, we have a service to our country, we have a service to the military, and we should be doing more of it.
Philip Zimbardo, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry Gross, thank you for having me.
Philip Zimbardo is the author of The Lucifer Effect.